Justice, after he is the king. And in that fight, although the Yakshas employed their powerful abilities of illusion, they were not able to subdue Dhruva Maharaj. Rather, Dhruva Maharaj became victorious. And although in illusion, but he was somewhat despondent due to the illusions created by the Yakshas, still the sages advised him to chant the holy names, because by chanting the holy names, taking shelter of Krishna's names, all illusion is dissipated. It is removed. So Dhruva did that, and he embarked on killing still more of the Yakshas. And then Swayambhuva Manu, who was his grandfather, he came to Dhruva Maharaj and he wanted to instruct him, because he wanted him to stop the killing. Now the remainder of this chapter, up to I believe text 35, retells the words of Swayambhuva Manu trying to stop Dhruva Maharaj from killing the Yakshas. Was some very interesting points, or ultimately the essence of Krishna consciousness, of bhakti yoga, will be explained. Because there Dhruva Maharaj is, and he's killing Yakshas. Now, why should he kill them? Or why shouldn't he kill them? What is the motivational force that should stop one from acting, or should inspire one to act? So this is an essential point for devotees to understand. Why do we act, and why do we stop acting? This is the essence of Krishna consciousness. And Swayambhuva Manu will explain this to Dhruva. So Swayambhuva Manu says first in text 7, "My dear son," he's his grandson, "please stop. It is not good to become unnecessarily angry. It is the path to hellish life. Now you are going beyond the limit by killing Yakshas who are actually not offenders." Here in this purport by Prabhupada. In this verse, the word atirosena means with unnecessary anger. When Dhruva Maharaj went beyond the limits of necessary anger, his grandfather, Swayambhuva Manu, immediately came to protect him from further sinful actions. So in one sense, he was protecting the Yakshas, who Dhruva Maharaj was killing. But in another sense, he was protecting Dhruva Maharaj too, because whatever actions we perform in this world, there are reactions to those actions. So, killing. And why was Dhruva Maharaj killing? Because his brother Uttama had been killed by a Yaksha. So that killing that he was going to do, that he was doing, thousands and thousands of persons, was going to entangle Dhruva in so much karma, so much reactions. So Swayambhuva Manu wanted to stop him, to protect him. He wanted to give him to clarify his method of discrimination of should he be doing this or shouldn't he be doing this. So Prabhupada continues, "From this we can understand that killing is not bad. But when killing is done unnecessarily, or when an offenseless person is killed, such killing opens the path to hell." So what does "killing is not bad" mean? Not in a whimsical way, "oh, killing is not bad." Means, what Prabhupada means, is that we tend to think There's a tendency for us to think in a very complete way that, oh, killing is terrible at all times and all circumstances. But actually, killing is not terrible in all times and all circumstances. It is not bad, inherently bad. It depends on what those time and circumstances are. For instance, if someone has killed another, and the judge orders that person that murdered to be killed, is that bad? Is it good? So one has to know the science of the law to understand that actually it's good. It's good for society. It's good also for the person who has done the killing, because he's purified by that. Otherwise he has to suffer so much. But to kill unnecessarily, that is what's bad. To kill animals, is that necessary? No, then it's bad. In a battlefield, to suddenly become non-violent, there's a war going on, and then someone says, the warrior says, well, I don't want to kill, like Arjuna said. Is that bad? No. Because sometimes there are bad things going on in the world. There are people bent on doing horrible things, and they must be checked by the military. And is that type of checking, that type of fighting, that type of religious war, is that bad? Is that type of killing bad? No, it's not. So it depends, as Prabhupada says very clearly, we can understand that killing is not bad. Not that whimsical killing is not bad, but sometimes killing is required. It is not inherently bad. So such killing, but when killing is done unnecessarily, or when an offenseless person is killed, such killing opens the path to hell. Dhruva Maharaj was saved from such sinful actions because he was a great devotee. Or another example, if someone is coming towards you or your mother or your child with a knife, and you have to stop them, you might have to kill them. Is it bad, or you will suddenly say, oh, it's not good to kill, so therefore I shouldn't do that? No, it's self-defense is required, or to protecting an innocent person. Dhruva Maharaj was saved from such sinful actions because he was a great devotee. So Swami Bhuvamana was preaching to him, and we'll see what the reasons that he gives. And only a great devotee can respond to these reasons. A kshatriya, Prabhupada continues, is allowed to kill only for maintenance of the law and order of the state. He is not allowed to kill or commit violence without reason. So sometimes if one is the person upholding the law, sometimes he has to brandish a weapon. And if you're brandishing a weapon, sometimes you have to use it. But unnecessary or without reason violence is always condemned. Violence is certainly a path leading to hellish condition of life, but it is also required for maintenance of the law and order of the state. Here Lord Manu prohibits Dhruva Maharaj from killing the yakshas. Why? Because only one of them was punishable for killing his brother Uttam. Not all of the yaksha citizens were punishable. So he was killing all of them, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of them, punishing them because they had killed, one of their kind had killed his brother Uttam. We find in modern warfare, however, that attacks are made upon innocent citizens who are without fault. And actually that type of war that's going on nowadays, where in all different places of the world, where just innocent people are killed, just the citizens, and we think that that's the way war is. But actually, that type of war has only been going on for less than 150 years. 120, 130 years, like that. Before that time, what would happen was the armies would meet in some place and they would fight, and whoever won won, and whoever lost lost. But the innocent citizens who have nothing to do with it, they were never targeted and killed unnecessarily. So this is just something taken as the from the progression of Kali Yuga, a big huge bomb dropped on a city, or so many bombs dropped on a city, or the citizens rounded up and massacred, regardless of whether they're men, women, old or young, just shot in the head. This is insanity. This is animal civilization. So modern warfare, the attacks are made on innocent citizens who are without fault. According to the law of Manu, such warfare is a most sinful activity. Furthermore, at the present moment, civilized nations are unnecessarily maintaining many slaughterhouses for killing innocent animals. So why has Prabhupada used the adjective unnecessary in relationship to the slaughterhouses? Why? Because it's not required. To live killing animals is not, it is simply not required for someone to maintain their lives in a healthy, happy way. When a nation is attacked by its enemies, the wholesale slaughter of the citizens should be taken as a reaction to their own sinful activities. That is nature's law. So on one hand, the soldiers killing the innocent citizens is horrendous. On the other hand, this is karma. The law of karma is involved in this because the citizens actually aren't innocent. As they have killed so many innocent animals, so they are being killed like animals. This is the very sad and unfortunate workings of karma. That is nature's law. So Manu said, there's only one yaksha who has killed your brother. Do not kill them in a wholesale fashion. My dear son, the killing of the sinless yakshas which you have undertaken is not at all approved by authorities. And it does not befit our family, which is supposed to know the laws of religion and irreligion. My dear son, it has been proved that you are very much affectionate towards your brother and are greatly aggrieved at his being killed by the yakshas. So you've proved, you've demonstrated your great love for your brother, that you could not tolerate his being killed. But just consider, Manu said, for one yaksha's offense, you have killed many others innocent. So Manu didn't approve of the killing of so many yakshas just because of Uttama's death. So then Manu starts explaining some philosophy. So there's going to be different elements of the philosophy that he explains, and the essence of it will be explained quite soon as the essence of the message of Manu to Dhruva. He says, one should not accept the body as the self, and thus, like the animals, kill the bodies of others. This is especially forbidden by saintly persons who follow the path of devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So your activities should be full of knowledge. No saintly person is going to approve of a human being acting as animals act. An animal, when he sees another animal that he wants to eat, he just kills him. Why? Because he's hungry to satisfy his hunger or something like that. He doesn't care or know that there is life within that body. He does not understand. He has not the intelligence to understand the suffering that the killed has to undergo. It is not possible for an animal to understand the suffering of another. They don't have consciousness that's developed in that way. They cannot understand how the soul is suffering so much when it is being killed. Can you imagine what it's like if a tiger would rip you apart? I mean, I just think that in previous lives you have been ripped apart by tigers, just ripped apart with its teeth and its claws. Just imagine what it would feel like that he's looking at you with that type of anger. He's so powerful, and he has so much anger, and he's basically, because he's hungry, and he's looking at you and thinking that your existence is simply meant to satisfy his hunger. And he rips you apart with his teeth and his claws, and the torture of your flesh being ripped apart. So the animal can't understand that. He has such anger within him and hunger. So don't be like an animal, he's saying, and just killing. It is very difficult to achieve the spiritual abode of Hari in the Vaikuntha planets. Very difficult. You're acting in this way, but it is so difficult to achieve the Vaikuntha planets. But you are so fortunate, Manu explains, that you are already destined to go to that abode, the Vaikunthas, by worshipping him as the supreme abode of all living entities. So you have worshipped Krishna, and the Lord has promised that you will go back to Godhead when this life is finished, and yet you are acting in this way. You are worshipping the Lord, but what are you failing to understand? That the Lord is within the hearts of all these yakshas as well. Even though they may not be conscious of it, but Krishna is within each and every one of their hearts. And you are causing them pain? You are causing the living entities pain? And Krishna is there as well? They suffer, and Krishna does not approve of that? So, practically speaking, the body is considered a temple. Why? Because the Lord lives within there alongside of the living entity, and you are killing them. So therefore, the unnecessary killing, as Prabhupada explains in his purport, of even an enemy is prohibited. Violence is always minimized, although it is not inherently bad. Because you're a pure devotee of the Lord is always thinking of you. This is very wonderful, even just that. Because the devotee is thinking always of the Lord is always thinking of the devotees. And you are recognized by all as his, by all, you are recognized by all his confidential devotees. Your life is meant for exemplary behavior. I am therefore surprised. Why have you undertaken such an abominable task? So he's really chastising his grandson, purport. Dhruva Maharaj was a pure devotee and was accustomed to always thinking of the Lord. Reciprocally, the Lord always thinks of those pure devotees who think of him only 24 hours a day. As a pure devotee does not know anything beyond the Lord, so the Lord does not know anything beyond his pure devotee. Swayambhuva Manu pointed out this fact to Dhruva Maharaj. Manu said, not only are you a pure devotee, but you are recognized by all pure devotees of the Lord. You should always act in such an exemplary way that others may learn from you. Under the circumstances, it is surprising that you have killed so many faultless yakshas. The Lord, this is text 13, so you shouldn't act in this way, Manu said. So how should you act? Because it's easy. It's easier sometimes to know what one shouldn't do. But to know what one should do is sometimes more difficult. For instance, there's always some revolution going on in the world where people are displeased with the government. So to rip down the government is one thing. But to replace it with something better is far more difficult. Far more difficult. So how should one act? What is the criteria which should govern how we should act? This is what's going to be explained by Manu to Dhruva Maharaj. Now, our position may not be that we're unnecessarily killing yakshas in revenge, and we may not be angry at them and killing thousands and thousands of them. But yet the same issue always comes up in our own lives, continuously, over big issues, big decisions, and also day by day, or month by month, or even hour by hour, and minute by minute. How should we act? What should be the criterion? The criteria by which we should act. Should we choose? Should we go left or right? So therefore, Manu says, the Lord is very satisfied with his devotee when the devotee greets other people with tolerance, mercy, friendship, and equality. So in other words, the principle that Manu is explaining is that we should act to please Krishna. We should act somehow or another to satisfy Krishna. So that's the criteria of success, whether our action has ultimately been successful or not. Has the Lord become pleased by it? So that is the meditation of a devotee. How can I please Krishna? So before one can do that very well, one has to know what will please Krishna. Because unless one knows what will please Krishna, how can one know how to act in such a way that Krishna will be pleased? So in relationship with dealing with others, how a devotee should act in dealing with others, Swami Bhuvan Manu is giving some criterion so that the Lord will be pleased. And therefore he says, he is satisfied with his devotee when the devotee greets other people with tolerance, mercy, friendship, and equality. Treating others with tolerance, mercy, friendship, and equality. Prabhupada's purport. It is the duty of an advanced devotee in the second stage of devotional perfection to act in accordance with this verse. There are three stages of devotional life. In the lowest stage, a devotee is simply concerned with the deity in the temple. And he worships the Lord with great devotion according to the rules and regulations. That's the lowest stage. One sees only the deity. And he worships the deity, has great reverence to the deity. But he doesn't see that anyone or anything else is worthy of reverence. He sees only God in the temple. In the second stage, above that, the devotee is cognizant of his relationship with the Lord. So he's aware of his relationship with the Lord, that he's a servant of God. And he's also aware of his relationship with fellow devotees. His relationship with persons who are innocent and his relationship with persons who are envious. So there's four different types of people whom he treats differently. He treats the Lord with great reverence. The devotees, he makes friendship. The innocent, he shows compassion to. And how do you show compassion to someone who has no knowledge? You give them knowledge. And finally, those who are envious, demonic envious of Krishna, he keeps his distance from. So that's the second class. It is advised that an advanced devotee should be tolerant. He should show complete mercy to persons who are ignorant or innocent. A preacher devotee is meant to show mercy to innocent persons whom he can elevate to devotional service. Everyone by constitutional position is an eternal servant of God. Therefore, a devotee's business is to awaken everyone's Krishna consciousness. That is his mercy. As for a devotee's treatment of other devotees who are his equals, he should maintain friendship with them. His general view should be to see every living entity as part of the Supreme Lord. But different living entities appear in different forms of dress. But according to the instructions of the Bhagavad Gita, a learned person sees all living entities equally. Pandita Samadarshana. Such treatment by the devotees is very much appreciated by the Supreme Lord. This was also explained in the teachings of Kapila Dev in the end of the third canto, how Kapila Muni explained that you can't be a devotee, really, unless one treats all living entities with compassion and affection. with friendship towards all living entities, regardless of what body they're in. Although one must be intelligent, obviously have enough common sense to know who you should be compassionate to and who you should be friendly to. Because an example given at that time was you can be compassionate to a tiger and chant Hare Krishna so loudly so he can hear it, or give him some prasadam, but you can't be friendly with a tiger or give him one of the devotees as prasadam, thinking that the devotee is made of prasadam, so I should be kind to the tiger and friendly to the tiger by feeding him a devotee. No. So regardless of the body the living entity, a soul is in, we should be compassionate and help them. So therefore, when we chant Hare Krishna loudly, it is beneficial to so many living entities hearing the holy names. It is said, therefore, that a saintly person is always tolerant and merciful. He is a friend to everyone, never an enemy to anyone, and he is peaceful. These are some of the good qualities of a devotee. Sarva Sarvabhushanam. That was again from the Kapila Dev's teaching, that last quotation. So he's saying this is how to satisfy the Lord. Now, are you, Dhruva Maharaj, are you treating these persons with tolerance, mercy, friendship, and equality? No, you're just killing them. Is that pleasing to the Lord? He's bringing up this issue, this criteria. So if one acts in that way, what is the result? Because naturally, when one is acting, doing something, one is interested in what result it's going to bring. So what is the result of acting in such a way that Krishna is pleased? One who actually, this is the following text, text 14, one who actually satisfies the Supreme Personality of Godhead during one's lifetime, what is the result? He becomes liberated from the gross and subtle material conditions. Thus being freed from all modes of material nature, he achieves unlimited spiritual bliss. So when we do something for our own pleasure, we may get some little pleasure from that activity. But always, because that activity is in the material realm, controlled by the modes of material nature, there'll be reactions against that, and we won't get much pleasure. We'll get so much misery following it. But if we act to please Krishna successfully and successfully please him, then the result we get is freedom from the material world and unlimited spiritual bliss. Brahma Nirvanam Vichati. He achieves unlimited bliss. Prabhupada's purport. In the previous verse, it has been explained that one should treat all living entities with tolerance, mercy, friendship, and equality. By such behavior, one satisfies the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and upon his satisfaction, the Lord's satisfaction, the devotee immediately becomes free from all material conditions. The Lord also confirms this in the Bhagavad Gita. Anyone who sincerely and seriously engages in my service immediately becomes situated in the transcendental stage, wherein he can enjoy unlimited spiritual bliss. So this is Vyavivachena. That one attains this Brahma-Bhuta platform, the spiritual platform, and can render devotional service. Mam chayo vivacharena bhakti yogena sevate saganan samatityaitan. One comes above the modes. So if one is continuously thinking what will please Krishna, what will please Krishna, one comes above the modes and he acts accordingly. Everyone in this material world is struggling hard in order to achieve blissful life. Unfortunately, people do not know how to achieve it. Atheists do not believe in God, and certainly they do not please him. Here it is clearly said that upon pleasing the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one immediately attains to the spiritual platform and enjoys unlimited blissful life. To become free from material existence means to become free from the influence of material nature. The word samprasane, which is used in this verse, means being satisfied. A person should act in such a way that the Lord is satisfied by the activity. It is not that he himself is to be satisfied. Of course, when the Lord is satisfied, the devotee automatically becomes satisfied. This is the secret of the process of bhakti yoga. Outside of bhakti yoga, everyone is trying to satisfy himself. No one is trying to satisfy the Lord. Karmis grossly try to satisfy their senses. But even those who are elevated to the platform of knowledge also try to satisfy themselves in a subtle form. Karmis try to satisfy themselves by sense gratification, and jnanis try to satisfy themselves by subtle activities or mental speculation and thinking themselves to be God. Yogis also try to satisfy themselves by thinking they can achieve different mystic perfections. But only devotees try to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So therefore, to constantly think, how will Krishna will be pleased? And then acting like that, because it takes such unselfishness and such fine consciousness, therefore it is very difficult to be an advanced devotee. It is simple in one sense to understand, but difficult to act always on that platform. And really the only one way one can do it is to be very pure and to be very much in love with Krishna. Pure means no impurities. And on the other side, love for Krishna. Only the devotees try to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The devotees' process of self-realization is completely different from the process of the karmis, jnanis, and yogis. Everyone else is trying to satisfy himself, whereas the devotee tries only to satisfy the Lord. The devotional process is completely different from the others. By working to please the Lord, by engaging his senses in the Lord's loving service, the devotee is immediately situated on the transcendental platform, and he enjoys unlimited bliss. Next verse. Now, up to this point, Manu has explained to Dhruva Maharaj that don't act in this way, but you should act in this way. Meaning this way means not act in a selfish, ignorant way like an animal, but you should act with the highest knowledge, which means that you should be pleasing the Lord. And the result of that will be that you will achieve such a wonderful platform, free from material nature, free from everything that it means to be within material nature, which is the body will crumble and everything will be crushed in time. But the soul, if we're free from material nature, the soul will experience eternal happiness, unending, Brahma Sokyam Tanantam, in this way. So why, if we act to please Krishna, that will be the result. So why does it work like that? Why do the devotees act in bhakti yoga to please Krishna? So now, in the next verses from text 15 to 26, and we won't complete all of them today, Manu is going to explain more about the Lord and his relationship with the living entity and his relationship with everything that's created. And when we understand who the Lord is, what is his nature, what is his position, what is his power, if we are not envious, we will also understand, by understanding this, what is our relationship with the Lord. Just naturally we'll understand that. And then by understanding what our relationship with the Lord is, and it's obvious what it is if we're calling him the Lord, He's the Lord. He's the Lord over everything. What does Lord mean? You have the dictionary? What does Lord mean?
Controller,
the ruler, powerful. You can't be a controller without being powerful. You can't be the ruler without being powerful. Just go and try and rule something. If you have no power, you'll see that no one listens to you. You don't make the rules at all. They don't follow them. So he is the Lord because he is the Lord. He's powerful, the controller, the ruler, the creator, etc. And we are tiny. Even though we'd like to think of ourselves as powerful rulers and controllers. But realistically speaking, we have to search the want ads for another position because we don't have the qualifications for that one. So now for these 11 verses, 12 verses, he's going to explain who the Lord is and what his position is. Here's how he begins. The creation of the material world begins with the five elements, and thus everything, including the body of a man or a woman, is created of these elements. Everything is created of just the five elements. By the sexual life of man and woman, the number of men and women in this material world is further increased. I'll read some of Prabhupada's purport here. When Swayambhuva Manu saw that Dhruva Maharaj understood the philosophy of Vaishnavism and yet was still dissatisfied because of his brother's death, so he knew that he should please Krishna, but yet he had a hankering to kill them all because his brother was killed. He gave him an explanation of how this material body is created by the five elements of material nature. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is also confirmed, Prakriti Kriyamanani, everything is created, maintained, annihilated by the material modes of nature. In the background, of course, there is the direction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, Maya Dakshena Prakriti, Suyate Sacharachara. In the ninth chapter, Krishna says, under my superintendence, material nature is acting. Swayambhuva Manu wanted to impress upon Dhruva Maharaj that the death of the material body of his brother was not actually the yaksha's fault. It was an act of the material nature. The Supreme Personality of Godhead has immense varieties of potencies and they act in different gross and subtle ways. So this is going to be the ultimate point that Manu is making to Dhruva in this point, that you're so angry at the yakshas for killing them, but nothing can happen without ultimately Krishna's sanction. And it's not that Krishna wanted your brother killed, even though we should note that previously the Lord said your brother will be killed and Saruchi will also be killed because of her offense to you. But this is the way material nature works. So you're blaming the yakshas, and on one hand, yes, they had something to do with it, but are you going to kill material nature? Material nature also had something to do with it. Are you going to kill the Daivikaran? The Supreme Lord is the cause. He also had something to do with it. And you're just killing the yakshas, and not only, yeah, so he's preaching to him strongly. And he's also saying, you're angry at them. Why is he angry at them? Because they killed his brother. But after all, who is brother in this material world? It's just a bodily connection. So many people are being killed every day, and you don't care at all. But why do you care when this one is killed? Because he's only bodily connection, and that bodily connection is illusion. So Manu continued. My dear Dhruva, it is simply by the illusory material energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and by the interaction of the three modes of material nature that creation, maintenance, and annihilation is taking place. So all this is going on. Your brother has been annihilated. Killing means annihilated. And ultimately, no one can avoid this. It's the law of nature. As one can't avoid creation, one can't avoid annihilation either.
My dear Dhruva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is uncontaminated by the material modes of nature. So he's doing these things, but he is not contaminated by this. This is actually a very important point. He is the remote cause, nimittika matram, the remote cause, the nimittik karan. He is the remote cause of the creation of this material cosmic manifestation. When he gives the impetus, many other causes and effects are produced, and thus the whole universe moves, just as iron moves by the integrated force of a magnet. So ultimately, you are so angry at the yakshas, but ultimately behind all this, every incident that takes place, there is Krishna as the ultimate cause. Prabhupada's purport, we'll read from about a third of the way down. A suitable example in this connection is that of the potter and the potter's wheel. So this is the example that's generally given in Vaishnava philosophy. There are three things. There's the potter, there's the wheel that the potter uses, and what's the third thing? The upadankaran, which is the clay. The clay, the wheel. Has anyone ever seen a potter make pots? Clay pots? Yeah. In India, you can see that all the time. They'll spin it and they'll get some clay and make it and do this and that and very quickly and put it to the side and let it dry in the sun. Very simple clay pots. So the potter's wheel rotates. So which is the cause of the pot? So we see the pot being produced. So you can say the potter is the cause, but you can say the wheel is the cause too, and you can say that the earth is the cause. So which is actually the cause? So the potter's wheel rotates and several varieties of earthen pots come out. There are many causes for the earthen pot. So we're saying three different causes. But the original cause is the potter. Yeah. Who sets a force upon the wheel. He takes the clay and puts it on the wheel and moves the wheel. That force comes by his superintendence. So the example is given, the comparison is that Krishna is like the potter. He makes it all happen ultimately. And the wheel is like the modes of material nature. And what's being created and broken, the ingredients, the upadan karan, is everything else in the material world that's being manipulated by the different forces. But ultimately it's by the potter. The force comes by his superintendence. That's the force to make the wheel spin. The same idea is explained in Bhagavad Gita. Behind all material action and reaction, there's Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna says that everything depends on his energy, and yet he is not everywhere. The pot is produced under certain conditions of action and reactions of material energy. So he's not directly producing it, but he's making it happen. But the potter is not the pot. In a similar way, the material creation is set up by the Lord, but he remains aloof. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Vedas, he simply glances over it and the agitation of matter immediately begins. So he is doing everything, and at the same time he is not doing everything. He is in everything. He is the ultimately everything, but at the same time he's completely aloof. He's doing something else. So the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by his inconceivable supreme energy, time, causes the interaction of the three modes of material nature. And thus varieties of energy become manifest. It appears that he is acting, but he is not the actor. He is killing, but he is not the killer. Thus it is understood that only by his inconceivable power is everything happening. So this is hinting at the Lord's, or not hinting, or the verse hints, but, and Prabhupada explains it more clearly in the purport, the Lord has an inconceivable relationship with the material world. That means we can't understand it fully. He is everything, he is making everything happen, but yet he is completely aloof from everything and has nothing to do with anything. There's nothing that's separate from him, but yet he is completely separate from everything.
We'll read some of Prabhupada's purport.
The word durvibhavya means inconceivable by our tiny brain. And vibhakti virya means divided in varieties of potencies. This is the right explanation of the display of creative energy in the material world. We can better understand the mercy of God by an example. A government state is always supposed to be merciful, but sometimes, in order to keep law and order, the government employs its police force, and thus punishment is meted out to the rebellious citizens. Similarly, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is always merciful and full of transcendental qualities. But certain individual souls have forgotten their relationship with Krishna and have endeavored to lord it over material nature. As a result of their endeavor, they are involved in varieties of material interactions. It is incorrect to argue, however, that because energy issues from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he is the actor. In the previous verse, the word naimittamatram indicates the Supreme Lord is completely aloof from the actions and reactions of the material world. How is everything being done? The word inconceivable has been used. It is not within the power of one's small brain to comprehend. Unless one accepts the inconceivable power and energy of the Lord, one cannot make any progress. The forces which act are certainly set up by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but he is always aloof from their action and reaction. The varieties of energies produced by the interaction of material nature produces the varieties of species of life and the resultant happiness and unhappiness. This is the inconceivable nature of the Lord, the way he deals with the material world. He is doing everything, but through his energies. It's like the prisoner, the prison department, as Prabhupada has explained. So the government sets up the prison department and the legal system, and then someone breaks the law, a citizen breaks the law, and what happens to him? He's thrown into jail. He's brought to trial and he's thrown into jail. So who has put him in jail? So one can say, well, the king put me in jail. And you can't say that's completely wrong, because the king, it's by the king's government, or the president or prime minister's government, that he was put in jail. But you can also say that the law put him in jail, because he broke the law and there was a punishment. So the law put him in jail. But you can also say that the judge put him in jail, because the judge ultimately sentenced him to 5 years in prison. But the prisoner, the criminal, shouldn't be thinking any of those things. He shouldn't be thinking, God put me in jail, or the law put me in jail, or the judge put me in jail, or the guards who dragged me to the cell and locked me in and put me in jail. What should he be thinking? He should be thinking, if he wants to get out, he should be thinking that I put myself in jail by my breaking the law. Then he can become rectified. But yet one can't say that Krishna didn't have anything to do with it, because all those different actors are true. So how much Krishna does and how much the individuals do, everything is happening by his power, but yet he's completely aloof. And how he does everything through others and yet allows their individuality, this is Achintya Shakti. Their individuality and free will. This is his inconceivable power. So one cannot blame him. This is the point. One cannot say, unless God made me do it, how could I? Because he's the supreme controller. So therefore, if I did something wrong, why are you blaming me? Not a blade of grass moves without God's will. So he did it, not me. So therefore, you should put God in jail. Why are you bothering me? Well, sometimes you say to people, when will you become religious? And they'll say, when God makes me become religious, then I'll become religious. But no, God already wants us to, but we don't want to. So we can't push it on him. It is us. But yet he's the supreme ultimate controller. So there is some inconceivability in that, in all this. So unless one understands that God doesn't fit neatly within our realm, our finite ability to understand things, then there is no meaning to God, because he's by definition infinite. And how can the finite, we who are finite, understand the infinite? So he said, everything is happening by his inconceivable power. I think we better stop here, because everyone will inconceivably go to sleep otherwise. And we didn't bring pillows and blankets, so it will be very difficult to have a good rest. So we stopped at 19. If Krishna allows, we're up to 19 now. If Krishna allows, gives us his supreme blessings and sanction, we will finish the chapter tomorrow. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Thank you. Any questions or comments?
How should we act?
We should act in such a way that Krishna will be pleased. That is the proper way to act. So when we say how should we act, usually we have something very specific within our own mind that we're wondering. So of course, not being a mind reader, I can't know exactly whether you should turn left or right. But we should, the discriminatory criteria that we should use is, will Krishna be pleased by this? And then that which will please Krishna we should do. But that is the standard of bhakti. So then the question comes, well, what happens? I ask Krishna what I should do, and I know what will please him, but my own desires are too strong. Maybe I'm too weak, or maybe they're strong in another way. So then, we, of course, we have to do the best we can, but we shouldn't forget what the actual standard is. And we will get some reactions maybe for not acting in the perfect way, but if we take those reactions upon our head properly, then we'll become purified by them. But we shouldn't forget what the actual standard is. And if we don't know what will please Krishna, we should ask someone who we are sure knows. We can pray to Krishna to help us for right discrimination. But very often Krishna until we are pure, we don't listen, because we have our own desires, and our desire to serve Krishna is covered by other coverings of the modes of nature. Is that okay? I simultaneously answered your question and didn't answer your question. What else?
Huh? If you didn't ask to act, should be full of knowledge.
Should act so that Krishna will be pleased. So that one needs, as you're saying, needs some knowledge. What is pleasing to Krishna? What is displeasing to Krishna? So what is pleasing to Krishna for us, that we become Krishna conscious?
Serving
him. So that which is favorable for our advancement in general is what's pleasing for him. And so there's six qualities of surrender. Sadvidam Sharanagati. You have a question? Paul, Chris.
It's just regarding the position of the Kshatriyas in Vedic society. Were they supposed to elevate themselves? To aspire to, become Brahmanas?
No.
Because their position seems to naturally incur karmic activities.
But if they act dutifully, see, Kshatriyas, they're very naturally and strongly have a lot of passion in them. So therefore they need an advisor to confer with. So the Kshatriyas always had Brahminical advisors. But they did their duty and they were detached. And by doing one's duty and being detached and doing it in a shastric way for Krishna's pleasure, then no reactions come. And that actually comes out later. When reactions come, what causes the reactions to come from the activity? It's the false ego in it. If one's doing, acting dutifully according to Shastra and according to the advice of those who have assimilated Shastra, just simply because it's the right thing to do, then no reactions come to the person. But because we want to enjoy that which we do, and we have no impetus to do anything unless it brings us our enjoyment, that means we invest our false ego in everything we do. And that's what causes the reactions, not the activity itself. So because the Kshatriyas tend to have passion, you can't be a Kshatriya practically without having passion. So because the Kshatriyas have passion, they tend naturally to invest all that they do with some false ego. So therefore they need someone to listen to who's right there. And those were the Brahminical advisors again. Is that the kind of answer you were...
So their duties would never be... Their expectations upon them were never advanced. Would never have hindered their spiritual advancement. Like, for example, we were told recently, a devotee, for example, shouldn't take offense.
Yeah.
Should try and be detached. Whereas the Kshatriya would be quick to...
So then the question is, what happens if the Kshatriya is a devotee? What should he do? Not take offense? Or take offense, right? So if it's like the position. If you're in the position, a Kshatriya is, it's not who you are. You're a soul, but you're acting as a Kshatriya, if this is the way a devotee would see it. So if his position, if he's the king, and this comes up later, this actually comes up later, this exact question. So if he's the king and someone... And he has a job to do. He has to rule the kingdom. And if someone offends him, if some thieves come and say, who is this king? What can he do? So if he just says, okay, he's offended me. He said that the king is weak. I can take it. It doesn't make any difference. I'm a soul. Then everyone will start stealing. So he has to act according to his position, but inside he's not exactly thinking like that. There's a difference when you act because it's your duty and when you act because you're with your false ego invested fully in it. And there's a difference between one type of anger and the other. So one is a Vaishnava is very purified if he's acting as a Kshatriya. And at the end of the life, Kshatriyas also gave it up, so that because there's a tendency to become entangled in this way. So at the end of their life, they give it up. And just like we heard Uttanapad, King Uttanapad, at the end of his life, he gave it up. Went to the forest to perform austerities, to break those attachments, which naturally tend to occur. And we're hearing the fifth canto about Priyavrata, also like that. Any other?
Does that mean then that all the varnas, to be a devotee is superior to the varnas, and it's like a tool to become a devotee?
Yes. But then again, when you become a devotee, does that mean that you leave your varnic activity? That's one of the big questions of the Bhagavad Gita. And the answer is basically no. Until you're very, very, very pure as a devotee, even until the heart is completely cleansed, should keep sthenaisthitasrutigatam tanavan manobhya ye priyaso dito dito pyasitas trilokyam. that the unconquerable Lord will be conquered if you just simply stay in your position and just hear about the Lord, engage in the Vaishnava aspects of your duty, and think, yatta pravata bhutanam, by this activity, my Lord, may you be pleased. Let me do it in such a way that pleases you. That's the general principle. But then when one's fully pure, yes, one can leave one's occupational duty. This is the basic subject matter of the first six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita and so many places.
So in a spiritual world, none of these classifications exist now.
They exist. Like Nanda Maharaj may be considered a Vaishya, but he's not a Vaishya. He doesn't even have a material body. But he's thinking that way for the Leela. So the classifications may exist, but not really. They don't exist in the same way they exist here.
I heard a statement on this point that Nanda Maharaj will act as a Vaishya because he likes to do that for Krishna. Is that?
You can say that, but that's his nature. That's his part. That's who he himself, his soul, has that relationship with Krishna as a father in the cowherd community. So, for that relation, for more than he likes to act as a Vaishya, it's that it's part of the situation that is pleasing to Krishna. He likes to please Krishna, and that's what he is composed of, that desire to please Krishna. That's who he is, expressed through his individuality. Everything that exists here exists there, but in a different way. Everything that exists here is a reflection of what exists there. So we see in the Krishna book how Nanda Maharaj had to pay his taxes. So he thinks that he has to pay his taxes, maybe. He thinks that, oh, if I don't take care of my son, he's going to protect him, he's going to get hurt. This is just an expression of everything he does, how he dresses, everything he does is an expression of his love for Krishna. That's all. That's what he's composed of. That's his individuality. So, of course, it's all hard to understand from our position here in the dregs of the material world, the view from the bottom of the barrel. Any other questions or comments? Okay, it's already late. So, if Krishna allows, on next Wednesday we'll continue. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Dhrumaraj ki jai, Swayambhu Vimano ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Gaura Bhaktivinoda ki jai.